Don.
I'm Don Moore. You're listening to Two Dimension, the comic book podcast with no direction. And with me today is Al Val, who does not like Saturday Night Live. Why?
Why don't I like Saturday Night Live?
Because they got rid of all the Friday or Saturday night horror hosts.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Back in the 70s, I forgot about that. Now you reminded me. Yes, SNL. But, you know, they're coming back now. We have, like, Sven Gulli now on MeTV and all that stuff. So
let's talk a minute about the local horror host.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because back when I was a kid in the prehistoric age, it was like, it wasn't just, there was that guys in the afternoon, there was guys at night, there was like shows where it would just be like an intro or whatever, and those are the ones that always got to me, you know, because they would hit you like unexpectedly, you know, you'd be watching a cartoon and all of a sudden this promo would come up and it'd scare the living crap out of you, so yeah. But then late at night they would get like usually the weathermen for the local station would dress up like a creepy guy or whatever. And, you know, he would host like a Universal horror movie, and it was great.
Yeah, Elvira, which a lot of people know, she was one of them. But I think in the 50s, there was a Vampira. I think she was one of them.
She was the first one, yeah.
But yeah, we had one in Oklahoma City, which my brother tells me is still doing it now, called Count Gregor, which I guess was...
Count Gregor is still around?
Well, my brother tells me, you know, everybody switched to the HD stations.
Yeah, yeah.
But he said that what they did was they kept the analog stations up, but he said they just play old movies and old TV shows for free all the time.
They have the analog stations still on in Oklahoma?
Yeah, that's what my brother told me.
I didn't know that was still around.
He doesn't
have
cable. I guess he uses
Netflix. Well, no, he picks them up through his digital box, probably. They're not coming analog anymore.
Yeah, but you know what I mean.
I know what you mean, the local stations, yeah. Yeah.
But he says... He's got Netflix, you know, he uses that, so I don't know exactly how he gets them, but he says he loves them, and they have those kind of horror hosts. He said Count Gregor does one, and I may be misquoting something, but I think they have a couple of other hosts they set up.
Wow, is there any way he could, like, you know, record them or anything like that?
they're still around, but you were the first person. Oklahoma City, the first few years of Saturday Night Live, wouldn't show it. I guess it was too controversial for that audience.
It's interesting.
They used to show, movies at night, which I didn't mind. I watched it. I didn't know what Saturday Night Live was. We missed the whole Chevy Chase time.
You missed the first year, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think the first couple of years. But I'd see them when I go down to Texas and think, what is this? But yeah, they didn't have a horror host. They just had one of the local TV personalities we have hosted. But, anyway, I was telling you, and you said good for them, and you brought up the horror host. Yeah, that's right. They did go away.
Well, the thing, too, is that the horror host would go away. Okay, as Saturday Night Live was and is still on NBC. So if your local NBC affiliate had a horror host, he'd probably be gone. But the other two stations would have the option to like still run a guy playing movies or whatever. So I guess, you know, they kind of still did, but nobody watched it. So they kind of, instead of having a guy and producing a show, they would play a movie with nobody on. And then afterwards it was infomercials. But in Pennsylvania, that Chili Billy guy who's still around, he's not a horror host anymore, but he's still alive and he still does shows and is very famous. And, you know, he's an interesting guy. You know, he was one of the horror hosts that was a normal guy. He didn't get dressed up. He wore a tuxedo. His show's kind of goofy, but it's local TV. It's fun. Well, he was on the NBC channel and they kept him on for years because he was doing great. You know, people would watch his show. So, maybe he wasn't on the local NBC. But when he was on his show, even when SNL was in their prime years, his show would get better ratings in the Pittsburgh area than Saturday Night Live would.
Wow, I really like Saturday Night Live, but. Yeah, there's a local horror host, I guess, from the Illinois area called Sven Gulli, you mentioned. It's on MeTV.
Yeah, we see him every Saturday night at 10.
Yeah, I watch the show.
He just had I read something. He just had like a stroke or a heart attack. I think he's okay, But I read some news on it that he was in the hospital for a while, so, you know, I hope he's all right.
I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, they're repeating ones. I think they're repeating them for now, but hopefully he'll be okay and come back. But he's been around for years. He's been around since, I think, the 70s.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Svengoolie has. Yeah, he was local to Chicago, and then I guess now with MeTV, they syndicated him. Yeah,
well, the show starts, he kind of tells a story, and he brings up local horror hosts, and they all went away, but he was, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He brought up. And one thing I like is, you know, at the end of one movie, they played those old Buster Crab Flash Gordon serials.
Right.
And it was great fun. I love those. And then another week, he said, you know, we've gotten so much feedback for that, we were going to do it again. But I don't know, it's nice. He just seems like, you know.
Yeah, if the movie's running short, he'll put on a serial just to fill up time.
You know, it's a lot of fun. It's almost like a big rock band come out, and then when they finish, a couple of guitar players come out and talk to the audience and do an acoustic set.
Yeah, right. Well, the thing about him that's good is that he actually talks about the movie, and he every once in a while he gets in the movie or they do something, but they don't do it that much. They had some other guys doing, you know, the shows, and he also shows the Universal movies, which are, you know, nice looking. Some of the other guys that used to be on, we had a retro TV network here, which was the same as MeTV, but it was a different station. They would play some other guys, and they would just show the same public domain movies that everybody saw. It was like, oh, okay, here's, you know, the character, and it's like, oh, really? You have to play The Terror, or you have to play, you know, The She-Beast, the crappy print of it or whatever. At least Svengoolie, you get, like, all the nice Universal titles that look nice. And I'll give them, you know, props for that. The other guys, you know, I don't mind if they're playing the public domain movies. That's fine. But they kept playing the same. It was almost like, let's just get this movie and we'll just do some jokes over it. You know, I'm not going to mention their names, but I wasn't that impressed with them. Svengoolie I like because he seems to be into it and he does other comedy bits and, you know, he does Stooges stuff.
Yeah, and he went to, what do you call it? Went to a convention.
And yeah, he does do it.
It was fun. They had a costume contest. I just thought that was great fun. It showed people, you know, taking pictures with him and stuff. He seemed like a nice guy.
Wow, so Count Gregor is still around. I thought he was like, I wonder if it's like, he must be in his 70s or something. I've seen pictures of him.
Yeah, well, when Al and I were talking about it one time, we looked up and I was kind of, I enjoyed that. They were showing on the internet and the interviews and stuff with him. But my brother said that he's doing stuff. He's still around.
That's amazing, yeah. Yeah, because we saw some new clip of him or a newer clip of it or
he
whatever.
He doesn't look any different to me.
Wow, so, oh, man, that's great. Well, I mean, yeah, that's the thing I miss about TV is local TV. It's become like everybody gets the same stations. It's like I want the individuality. I want the local areas to have their own. I mean, they're going to have their own newscasters and local news and all that stuff, but the locally produced shows is what I miss now, you know, because everything, like, it's a feed from, you know, wherever, you know, from like a national feed or
it's all
a cable feed.
Same.
It's like, oh, yeah, okay.
Well, even newspapers. We've discussed this before. When I moved here, I was really shocked at the St. Pete Times. It's just how beautiful the paper was. And, they had a political cartoonist called Clay Bennett. I guess he's with the Christian Science Monitor or something now. He's fantastic. But they had these layout artists. I remember one time somebody pointed out the food section. They were talking about lobsters, and they had illustrations of lobsters that went all the way across the whole page. And, you know, my dad, who worked for the Oklahoma newspaper, he'd come up and say, well, you really got an interesting-looking paper. But it was heavily illustrated and designed, and that's all gone.
This is in the 80s?
Well, yeah, 80s and 90s.
Okay.
And, but, you know, you look at papers now, sometimes if you go on the internet, people even show examples of each newspaper is completely different. Sometimes they even had their own cartoonist working for the newspaper, local cartoonist. And all that's gone away. It's all just, you know, wires, you know, AP wires, and no, you know, all the front pages basically look the same. They're not laid out. There's no personality to it.
Yes, because I think some of them are owned by companies, bigger companies, and they make them look kind of like. It's like I went online and there was like an Indianapolis newspaper. Well, this is online. This isn't the regular newspaper. But my friend at work was looking at it. He goes, "That's funny," because I go on. He goes on the Detroit newspaper and it's the same layout. So this is online, but it was just like. Whatever company it was, the same layout, same font, same look, and it's a different paper. So I guess they're doing it in print, too. I don't know. I haven't looked at a newspaper in I don't know how many years.
Well, you know, Robert Crumb, the underground cartoonist, he was talking about that. He was reading the book about the guy that started Nabisco, the baking company. And he said what he, I think he was a lawyer. He was some type of, you know, professional. And he went up and bought up a whole bunch of local bakers all over the place. And they told him, all right, you'll be doing this. And they was baking the same thing over and over. And then they were boxing everything up, sending them out, and telling housewives, you don't have time to do all this stuff. It says, you'll just be buying this. And that was the history of that company. And his argument was all those age-old recipes each bakery had are long gone. And, you know, I mean, think about it. When you're on the road, you don't stop at some local place. You stop at McDonald's, you know, somewhere you know that you know what it's going to taste
right,
like.
Right, yeah.
So, I mean, that's just, I guess, the modern world, but...
I mean, the locals usually go to the local places, yeah. I mean, that they know about. But if you're just traveling, yeah, you're going to go to the safe place to eat because you don't want to take a chance and the place, you know, really stinks or whatever. You know, I mean, yeah, like the locals know. But, I mean, with comics, it was, you know, it was the good thing about it is the internet, as far as comics goes, well, there will be diversity. That will take it away from just being Marvel and DC and the independents and distributed by a certain, you know, distributor. And it'll be like, basically, if you've got a blog, anybody can put out their own comic book. And then you just promote it. And basically, if it does good, great, awesome, you got a book. And if it doesn't, well, try again or whatever. That's where it's going to get pretty interesting, I think, in the future, as if it isn't now already.
Right. Well, there's a lot of diversity. That's one thing I'm always being told and I've seen, but it's just hard to find some of that. Everywhere I go, everybody has the same thing. It's the big mainstream publishers, and a lot of the books look the same. But if you really look hard and you're lucky, you can find some. Or if you go to online sites and order them. Mm-hmm. You can get them. So, yeah, there's a bunch of different stuff, but it's just not readily available for everybody.
Some of the artists, like, have their own blogs, and then they link you to their friends. And when you link to their friends, you see other guys that, you know, do work or whatever, and you're like, oh, okay. I found this one artist called Dan McDade. I don't know if he works in the U.S. or not. I think he works in Britain, and he does Judge Dredd or works for that. He's a real nice kind of, you know, semi-realistic, semi-cartoony guy, but I found him through a site called Whatnots, which is where a lot of, like, American comic book artists. So, you know, you go through there and you find stuff and it'll lead you in other directions. And, you know, if, like, you know, every once in a while I play this game where it's like, okay, today I'm going to look for a blog spot that I've never seen before. And I'm going to, like, just find a link. And at that link, I know maybe it'll take me somewhere else. And maybe I'll find somebody new or something like that. And then you can, you know, find... probably maybe people that are working in comics that you didn't know and you liked their work or whatever. There's a lot going out there that's not, you know, plus YouTube, as far as the horror host goes, YouTube, there's horror hosts on there now. You know, they just like, they just pop up doing the movies or whatever. I think there's some guy on Hulu that's got a bunch of shows on there too. So you can it's a free Hulu, I think. So you can go online and find those guys. And if you got a big enough computer screen, just hit full screen and, yeah, if they're high res, you can watch the show on TV or, you know, have it boom to your TV, however you do. So it's out there.
If you get a cable, you can hook up your computer to the TV and watch it.
So it's out there. It's just finding it because it's infinite what you can find out there. So, you know, but that's the good thing. As far as music, too, I'm sure there's probably a lot of bands out there that have, you know, blogs or webs. Do people still do websites anymore? Is everybody doing blogs now?
No,
pretty
people
much.
People have websites.
There's people still doing websites or whatever. Because all I hear is blogs a lot.
Well,
you know,
the difference is
it's easier to make a blog, right?
Yeah. Well, websites. There used to be a lot of places like GeoCities, Angel Fire, still around. But you know, they give you so much space and you can build something and put, you know, and they'll host it. But Angel Fire gives it to you, but they have ads on it, and some people get irritated by those. But you only have so much space, and if you want more space, then you pay for it, which, you know, fair enough. A lot of musicians and, you know, artists will open up their own website. Blogs are free, and they're basically infinite. I think somebody called them weblogs, and they just went to blogs. But all it is you post it as much as you want. You can add photos, illustrations, you know, whatever. And people just, you know, it's like a diary, an online diary. A lot of animators have blogs. Somebody said they're really lonely just working alone, so they post their drawings and talk and come up. But yeah, but the blog's free, and I've never heard of any issue on how much you can put on a blog, you know.
Yeah, we're trying to put as much as possible on our blog. we're pushing the limit on that. Let's see if they start complaining one day or something. But yeah, no doubt about it. Yeah, because I mean, it's like, okay, fine. With a website, I guess you can do more graphics, maybe, or you can do more like, you know, slick and eye-catching things.
Yeah, you can be one whole page and control it, whereas a blog is just a narrow strip that, you know, scrolls down.
Exactly.
And like Dallas puts his comic strip, The Mighty Blue, on a blog, but you have to read it backwards because he posts a page, and then, you know, the next week he'll post a second page, and what shows up is the newest page. You can't read them sideways. You have to read them up and down, start, you know. And I thought that would be if he had them on a website, he could set it up to where you could read them, you know, left to right, you know, go around. You can also put bigger graphics on it. You control everything, and you can, you know, have section after section, page after page.
Yeah.
Instead of just scrolling down this one long, you know,
list. Of course, on the blog, on the right-hand side, you can have the pages, you know, linked, so you can go to the first one and then, you know, go up or whatever. But yeah, when you go to a website, you can put every page in little thumbnails, and you can start off at the beginning and, you know, go all the way to the end or whatever. There's more, you know, diversity, but yeah. But like you said, the blogs are free. I mean, you know, they're good. We're doing, you know, we've done a lot with it. So.
Oh, yeah, blogs are fun. But, yeah. No, websites are still around.
Is GoDaddy like another host or whatever?
I don't know. It might be.
I don't know if they're...
I don't know what that is. I always see it advertised.
I thought they were a web host. I mean, I'm not 100% sure.
Well, it could be. It could be.
You know, I know Angel Fire and but you're right, Angel Fire and some of those other ones, it was like Pop-Up City when you went on there. It was just like, you know, your content was like just a portion of it. The rest of it was just ads for...
Well, you know, I mean, they're giving you all this space for free, which is nice, so I understand. And, you know, a lot of us, we put up a site. It's just a vanity site. It's just for fun that, you know, we got up. And so, you know, if they put a couple ads on it so you can have something free, all right, you know. But.
Yeah, take what you can get or whatever. So back to the matter at hand, comic books. What's the deal with those FFs there? I've never seen those before, those Alan Davis ones from 98.
A lot of us have been ordering off, you know, these online sellers, and I like Alan Davis, and I just started wondering about, I'd always once in a while find out from somebody about some series he did I wasn't aware of. So I went to, you know, Wikipedia, looked up Alan Davis, and I wrote down every one of them. I didn't realize he did so many issues of X-Men. You know, I never knew that. And he did a really nice series of Fantastic Four I bought and trade called The End, which is, I guess, 6 issues, and it was supposed to be the last Fantastic Four story, which I thought was fantastic. And, I looked up in 1998, he did 3 issues of the Fantastic Four. It says Heroes Return. I guess they were gone for a while.
Yeah, I guess.
And I wonder if this tied in when Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld did that Heroes Reborn.
Yeah, I was out of reading comics around those
really?
Years, so I don't
know. I remember when that happened because somebody at work was talking about it. They were excited. So, yeah, they changed Captain America's mask, and I guess they were. I guess it's kind of like Image-style Marvel, and they just did a few issues, or I guess it was like a miniseries. I got the first 3 issues of this book, and it's just called Fantastic Four, and above it says Heroes Return. And reading these, Scott Lobdell wrote it, and of course Alan Davis and Mark Farmer were the artists. And they kept talking about they'd been gone for a year. I guess they were in some other reality. And didn't realize it, and then came back and realized they were in the wrong place. And in these issues, Alicia Masters, the blind sculptress that was the girlfriend of the Thing, is now with the Silver Surfer. Some other group was in the Baxter Building, and the Fantastic Four had to go on a pier warehouse that Reed Richards kept all their stuff in. And that's now the headquarters. Okay. But They're nice. Al saw them and said, I didn't get these. He thought they were new books, but they were from 98.
Is that like three in a row, or is that like...
Yeah, it's the first three issues.
He stopped doing it after that?
Yeah. It's the only ones they had listed, and I'm looking at the third issue, the last page. The story ended, and then it just said, let's all give a tip of the hat to Mr. Davis and Farmer, our fantastic art team, who bid us a fond farewell. This issue, making way for Salvador LaRocca and Art Thiebert. Thanks, guys.
Okay, I remember those guys, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, they were really good, too. But I love Alan Davis. I guess I got used to him writing his own stories. They were good, but I just didn't find the stories that fantastic. But I did find the artwork phenomenal.
Yeah, well, he was, okay, he started doing, what, Captain Britain, or was he started, he'd start with Warrior Magazine?
No, Captain Britain was his first work.
Because I remember a long time ago getting that tabloid kind of black and white Captain Britain book, but I didn't know if that was the first thing he ever did or not.
Yeah, he did. I don't think it was before that Captain Britain book you could buy in the United States. I think they're in those little newspapers that Marvel put out.
Yeah, that was it.
And I think Dave Thorpe was the writer, and then... At one point, Dave Thorpe left, and Alan Moore came in. And then he wrote with Alan, or worked with Alan Moore all through the Captain Britain. And then from there, he stepped in and took over Marvel Man from Gary Leach.
Yeah, because I remember Marvel Man or Miracle Man or whatever it was called.
Marvel Man.
That had a different artist at first.
Yeah, Gary Leach.
Was it Gary Leach who drew it first? And then
Alan Davis.
Alan Davis took over. I just remember the Gary Leach ones. I don't remember the Alan Davis ones.
Well, I don't know why Gary Leach left, but that's when it was in Warrior Magazine. And so Alan Davis took over, and he was trying to keep it as consistent to Gary Leach as he could. And then Warrior Magazine, you know, went out of business, and that was it.
Now, okay, because I don't remember the story. You weren't able to call it Marvel Man in the U.S. because of Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
But
just like Captain Marvel.
But why? So it was called Marvel Man in Britain, but wasn't it Marvel Man? Wasn't it a revamping of an old character from the 60s or something?
You and I were talking on one past episode, and we started talking about French comics, and I kept trying to remember what I was talking about.
Yeah, right.
Well, this is what I was going to talk about. You could buy American comics, you know, in England. And I guess it was after, it was in World War II, when all of a sudden you couldn't bring American comics over any longer. The Nazis stopped some of it, but I'm kind of butchering this history. There was other things going on, but the Captain Marvel comics from Fawcett, you know, the Marvel family, was very, very popular over in England. As they were in the United States. Suddenly, they were gone. They couldn't bring them over. I think there was a couple other things besides that. It was importing stuff, whatever.
This is, we're talking in the 40s.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or maybe either the 40s or the 50s.
Early 50s, okay.
But they were gone.
Well, if it was the 50s, it couldn't have been the Germans, the Nazis. So.
No, well, I know that the Germans and Nazis in World War II stopped a lot of the stuff coming over France, and that's where the French comics started changing.
Started doing their own thing.
And
yeah.
I'm thinking maybe it was when, whatever the reason, it might have been also that when DC stopped Fawcett from publishing Captain Marvel.
Okay.
It might have been then. Right. Anyway, the comics were really popular in England. The English wanted them, so that's when Mick Anglo started doing Marvel Man.
This is in the 60s.
I don't know if it was the 60s or the 50s.
Was it in the 50s? Okay, all right.
Haven't you read the book I lent to you?
I haven't read that part about it.
The Comic Book History Comics? Do you have it around here?
I thought I gave it back to you, but maybe I didn't.
You didn't.
Okay.
Time to get the forklift out to dig through it.
All right, it's here. Anyway.
Anyway, Mick Anglo did Marvel Man, and there was Marvel Man, there was Kid Marvel Man, and...
So that story is in there.
Young Marvel Man. Yeah, they tell the story
about him. Okay, all right.
How he did it. I always wondered, looking at those Alan Moore stories, they start out with an old Marvel Man story, which looks kind of like an old Fawcett, you know, Captain Marvel story. And what was told from, I think the guy Des Skin, I'm guessing that's who it was, whoever published Warrior Magazine.
Yeah, Des Skin, yeah.
Told Alan Moore that it was in a public domain. So Alan Moore wrote all of his Marvel Man stories believing it was in public domain. Come to find out it wasn't. Mick Anglo had
right.
Anyway, Marvel...
Warrior, I remember this now, yeah.
Yeah, Marvel... Warrior Magazine, you know, they didn't make it, you know, was canceled after so long. And Alan Moore came over and started writing Swamp Thing and got to be, you know, a big deal. And it got to the point where they were wanting anything that, you know, Alan Moore wrote. And Eclipse Comics in 1985 brought Marvel Man over. And then Marvel Comics said, you can't call him that. You know, we own Marvel. So they called him Miracle Man, which I guess Alan Moore was really upset about. And so it was Miracle Man. It was a popular comic. And somehow there was a dispute between Alan Davis and everything else. The Captain Britain stuff couldn't be printed because somehow in Marvel UK, the artist owned part of it on copyright as well as Marvel Comics. So Marvel Comics owned part of Captain Britain, and so did Alan Davis, and so did Alan Moore. Because all the stuff going on with Alan, with Jack Kirby, Alan Moore wouldn't sign his part away so they could publish those old stories over here. Alan Davis, from what I remember, was getting upset about it because he wanted his work shown over here, and it was some work he was really fond of, and he got aggravated. So when Miracle Man was coming out, he was really dragging his feet on it, not wanting to sign it. And I guess the publisher at Jan Mulaney, I think it was, for Eclipse.
Dean Mulaney.
He was really upset at him. And finally, Alan Davis just gave his 35% of the character over to Gary Leach. And so he didn't do anymore. He just, you know, he republished the stories Alan Davis did. And then I think after that, Chuck Astin drew an issue. And then after that, I think he ended up being Steve Bissett and John Tottleman, maybe, or John Tottleman.
Did Marvel Man, Miracle Man?
Yeah, finished the whole Miracle Man series.
Oh, yeah, I never got that far on it.
Well, Rook has them, so whenever we see Rook, you can borrow them if you like. It's,
yeah.
The only issue, there's some of the first five issues of that American run, up to Alan Davis, is just some of the best comics I ever read. But then when he finished it, it was after he was doing Watchmen. And, you know, Dallas read them, we talked about them, and Dallas said, you know, the first five issues, like I said, were just terrific. And he says it seemed like he lost interest after it. I think basically he was finishing the story, but the enthusiasm wasn't there. You know, it was good. There were some really neat things to it, and the ending kind of threw me. You know, how he wrote it, so I wouldn't have thought of that. You know, it's Alan Moore, but I guess after he did Watchmen, he just didn't really care anymore.
Yeah, well,
it was kind of along the same lines.
Moved on to other things or whatever, yeah.
But that was the story, so that's why, you know, Marvel Man came about, was because you couldn't get Captain Marvel anymore, and the British wanted more stories.
I wasn't sure. You know, when you started telling the story, then about thinking that they were public domain, then I started registering in my mind. I do remember that story now. But I didn't remember the part about because of the Captain Marvel family or anything like that, because they don't look anything. Well,
yeah, they do.
Yeah, I guess they do kind of, sort of, you know.
When I was reading these in the 80s, right. I'm thinking, how in the world are they getting away with this? Because, you know, I mean...
Yeah, you're right, they do kind of.
They, you know, I mean, they're different, you know, and I think the Marvel Man costume, the one Gary Leach redid, is really something. It's a neat design. I used to draw it all the time wishing, man, I wish I would have came up with this. But, you know, and the other thing was it had Marvel Man Jr., and Kid Marvel Man.
Yeah, you're right, yeah.
You know, it wasn't Mary Marvel or anything, but it was the same thing. And also,
that's right.
They said Atomic backwards. Instead of Shazam, it was Komoda, which was
that's
Atomic
right,
backwards.
Yeah, yeah.
But Young Marvel Man, he said Marvel Man to change, just like Captain Marvel Jr. said Captain Marvel to change.
Yeah, you're right.
And,
yeah.
You know, it was a fun series.
I remember the one story where it was like what they were doing was they had like the characters like in some kind of suspended animation, and they were implanting their stories in their brain by some doctor or whatever. So basically what you were reading was like there some adventures that were just like basically like, you know, implanted in their brain. I thought that was an interesting concept or whatever.
Yeah, and that was the other thing. There was also a woman later.
Yeah, there was. There was. Yeah, there was.
She wasn't a girl like Mary Marvel. She was older, and that was the other thing they talked about in the series that he, I guess, instead of Black Adam, you know, the bad guy in Captain Marvel, it was Nasty Young Man. And she was talking about, I guess the government was kind of overseeing the Marvel Man project.
Yeah.
But they said they weren't aware of Nasty Young Man and that woman. So they had them, I guess that doctor was doing all kinds of perverse things to him all the time. And she said, "You won't believe what they put us through."
Exactly. I do remember that now.
I forgot about that. Yeah, that's right. Because in the series, she was I think she was a doctor or something.
Yep. Yep. And then, I remember now.
When they found her, she immediately said Komoda and turned into whatever she was, and it all just she started explaining the story to him.
Cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's take a break now because we're already at the halfway point. And what music are we going to have this week? Do you know,
we're
sir?
Playing our friend Gene Wallace.
All right, Gene. There you go.
This is original. Little Johnny Winter walking in the snow, thinking about his troubles and what he does not know. Walking down the lane like a little boy does do, thinking about his troubles and what he's gonna do. Mother is gone, I can't go on, oh what will I do? Daddy was drunk and could not walk, he staggered to and fro, went to get another drink and fell into the snow. My story is through, what shall I do? My daddy's gone now too. Little Johnny Winter walking in the snow, thinking about his troubles and what he does not know. Walking down the lane like a little boy does do, thinking about his troubles and what he's gonna do.
And that was Gene Wallace. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Gene. As I will say, thank you very much.
Yeah, Gene's a friend of ours. We work with her, and it's kind of odd. You know, you meet somebody from a completely different place, and as soon as you meet, you start finding out that your lives have kind of gone along the same lines, except that I can't sing as well as she can, nor can I play guitar.
Well, not yet, anyway. You're working on it.
I'm working on it.
Yeah, there's going to be the Don Moore experience soon at a record store near you if you can find one.
You know, even when Gene talks to me, it sounds kind of melodic, you know, and yeah. I guess I shouldn't have been surprised she could sing so well, but I've heard her play guitar before.
Well, she played at the one of our Inside Out things, and she was good.
I love when she sings that Patsy Cline song, I Fall to Pieces.
That's a great song.
Yeah, and she does it really well, so thanks for giving us a song to play on here, and that's her own composition.
All right. So getting back to that book that I should read the whole thing, I tell you, I was very much interested in reading the comic book store section because I had, like, I lived through that, so, but.
Yeah, this is the comic book history of comics we talked about in an earlier show, and Al borrowed it, and he read what he wanted to read, and
I didn't read everything.
He won't read everything, which is a mistake. I can't recommend this book enough, but I butchered the history pretty bad, so now we're going to correct it.
All right.
They had American comics, you know, they were printing in England, and all the horror comics that were popular over here, the EC stuff, was popular there. Anyway, it goes into the whole anti-comics, U.S. comics in Britain, and legislation that came up.
Oh, the Wortham stuff or whatever?
Yeah, but they had some. I'm not going to get into the whole story by the book. But anyway, in 1955, Parliament passed the Children and Young Persons Charitable Publications Act, which made selling crime or horror comics that would tend to corrupt a child or a young person into those hands that might fall punishable for up to £100 and or 4 months in jail. Aren't these people that came up with punk rock?
Yeah, but that was 20 years later.
Okay, but anyway, it was only enforced one time, and that was in 1970, when L. Miller and Company was fined £25 for reprinting American horror comics. So after that, L. Miller began reprinting America's Fawcett comics for the British market in the mid-1940s. And, anyway, Fawcett, of course, is the one that did Captain Marvel, which DC sued in...
Because DC bought Fawcett, right?
Well, no, they didn't buy them then. They basically...
put them out of business?
It goes in about 3-4 panels with a lot of text about, you know, the judge did this, there's a lot of red tape, and finally it was the Wortham stuff that started happening.
Mm-hmm.
And this is DC appealed in a 1952 story Judge Learned Hand of the U.S. Second Circuit reversed the original decision siding with DC and sending the case back to trial court for a determination of damages. I guess originally the first judge went in Fawcett's favor. By this time, however, superhero sales were tanking, including Caps, and Wortham's Witch Hunt was gaining serious steam. So that's the whole, you know, Dr. Wortham. Ugh. And it says, meanwhile, Fawcett had been experimenting with mass-market paperbacks, Mickey Spillane's lurid Mike Hammer mystery, I, the Jury, sold over 2 million copies in the new format. And that's, yeah, Fawcett created the paperback book.
Did market. They really?
Yeah.
Cool.
Determining further battle with DC would be futile, Fawcett settled the case in 1953 and canceled its entire comics line to focus on paperback prose. Yeah, so it stopped in 1953. And again, growing up, I'd see images of Captain Marvel once in a while and ask who it was. He was like Superman, okay. And then it was at the end of 1973 is when DC bought, you know, the Captain Marvel, all the Fawcett stuff.
Yeah.
And started printing it out. But anyway, L. Miller and Son, Fawcett's British publisher, reprints of Captain Marvel and Captain Marvel Jr. were their best-selling comics. Cut off from its supply of U.S. material, Miller hired artist-writer Mick Anglo Studio to create British knockoffs. So that's how they got away with it.
Gotcha.
So.
Gotcha, yeah.
Anyway, and then Alan Moore came in and, you know, the rest is just
history.
Changed.
Yeah. Okay, so now we know. Well, any question that we have, we're just going to refer to that book.
So I'm going to challenge Al to read all the other stories besides that one little tiny thing. And I can't recommend this. The Comic Book History of Comics by Fred Van Lente and Ryan Dunleavy. It's just a terrific book.
I tell you what, for the next show, I'm going to read a couple more chapters and we're going to talk about it.
There
How's
you go.
That?
I'll work with that. I can do that.
We can do that, yeah.
This goes, I'm telling you, this isn't just a little bit of history that somebody gave. It tells the entire history in comic book form, and they bring up stuff, some of it I did know and was sort of aware of, and the other things that kind of fit in the... But they talk about animation, they talk about Disney, they talk about the Fleischers, it talks about Will Eisner and Jack Kirby, and it's just really interesting to see the whole flow. And then it gets in all the underground comics that appeared in the 60s and 70s, goes all the way up to Art Spiegelman. It talks about the whole British invasion and all the books in the 80s.
Talk about all the great Image books like Ali Field and all that.
It doesn't go into in-depth, but it does talk about when the Image guys, why they left Marvel and what was going on at Marvel.
That story, yeah.
And it keeps going. But it's a really, really strong book.
Well, when I read the comic book store section, I lived through everything up to the when Marvel started distributing their own books. I guess that was like the real end of it. I thought it ended like right after Superman died and it was going downhill. But yeah. I guess when Marvel Heroes World or whatever the hell that was called, I guess that was when it really
Yeah, well, there was a bunch of different things that were happening, and you know, it wasn't just one thing.
Mm. Yeah, because I got to tell you, from like 95, now that I never even thought about it, but now, yeah, now I'm remembering it. From about 95 till about 2000, I didn't buy any comic books around that time.
Really?
Yeah, I just kind of got out of it for whatever reason. Then, like in 2000, well, I'd gone back to school, and I started learning computer graphics and stuff like that. And when I got a job doing computer graphics down in South Florida, well, they'd give us like an hour lunch. So I just drive down to the comic shop, Tate's, that was about 20 minutes away. And I just said, well, let me go buy a few comics. And that's when I started back again. Because in all actuality, when I started working there, this is kind of an odd story, but, this is how one big comic shop down there kind of like ended. When I first started working at this graphics, like right down the road, it was maybe half a mile, there was a store called Tropic Comics, and it was a pretty big store. They'd been one of the first comic book shops in Broward County, was there, and I went a couple of times, but what was happening was that on the road that it was on, which was a main intersection, State Road 7441, they were redoing the entire road. I mean, they were destroying it. There was traffic, but it was a mess. So like within like about a year or maybe even less of all this construction, Tropic Comics, just after all these years, they just went under. They said, the hell with it. We're getting out of the business. And they just went totally eBay because that was starting to open up now. So, another shop called Tate's, which was a smaller shop at the time, opened a little bit further north. And I would go there. And now they're like a big, huge mega store or whatever. But I just go there and buy comics. And that's when it started back up again. But I hadn't. Mm. I gave it up for a few years.
I've never given it up. My only issue was, there was no place around here to buy them, that I was willing to go to. And I would just pick them up when I go on vacation. I'd find a store and I'd do it that way. Sometimes friends of mine would go to MegaCon or something. They'd pick up books, if I was looking for certain things. But I was out of it, but not my choice. And I'd always find them somewhere, but...
Yeah, bottom line was I had a bunch of comics anyway to read, so I would just read them and all that stuff. But I just kind of got out of it. When I got back in, I wasn't buying the new ones. I was getting like, it's funny. I would go there on my lunch break, and I'd spend like maybe 20 minutes there, and I'd be looking for like older books, like from the 70s or whatever, but the cheaper ones. And I didn't care who they drew them. It was like, oh, because I hadn't gotten comics in a while. It was like, oh, this is like a Don Heck. That's cool. This is like like a Bob Brown. That's cool. And I remember one time that was funny that like I bought these like about $10 or $15 worth of these like $1 and $2 like Marvels that weren't the main titles, And the girl that ran the counter, she goes, I have to ask you a question. Why are you buying these? And he goes, well, because I like the artist. She goes, yeah, I do too. I was just wondering why you were buying these particular ones. And I'm like, oh. They're cheap, and I like the art. She goes, oh, that's cool, so.
It's funny. I never think about that, but I was in California again on vacation, and I was going through the quarter boxes, and I was pulling up these oddball books that I like, but the reason I was pulling them out was because I thought, well, I've never seen it like this, and I was wanting to take them and look at them and then draw some of the stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
And one of the guys that worked the store walked up to me and goes, are you an artist? Yeah. I thought so. Why?
Really?
And he says, because that's the only people that ever go through the books is, these boxes, they're artists. And then, he asked me for drawings, so I, went out and grabbed some of my stuff in the,
wow.
Car, and then he showed me his, We went through the whole thing, but, that's probably why she asked you that. I went through once.
I never thought about that. You know what? That probably is, because she was really inquisitive. It was like, oh, she goes, I get them too. And I was like, she didn't keep going that she was an artist. And I was like, yeah, you're probably right.
Well, I guess you don't have to be an artist to like them. Sometimes, usually, like I said, and this is a complaint, when you go into stores, they have all the mainstream stuff, and that's it. And some of that's fine. I like it. I know other people like others, but. They don't have some of the smaller books that I really love dearly. And it's fun to look through some of these, smaller creators and stuff. And I used to find stuff and think, oh, I've never thought of that. I've never seen that. And you'd take it home
exactly.
And try to figure out how they drew it and how to do this and that. And
exactly, yeah. Yeah, you're right because, we're both artists. And when there were quarter piles back in the day, that's where I used to go first at the comic shop, to the quarter pile, to find like cheaper versions of oh, wow, Joe Cooper did this, Kaluta did that. And it was because we're artists and we're looking for other artists. We weren't necessarily looking for, you know, the best, you know, the new books or, you know, the stories as much, even though we liked them.
Right.
We're looking for the art. Yeah, that makes sense now. I didn't really think about it.
Yeah, she's probably wondering why you weren't treating it as a commodity and you're just getting old books. You know, I mean, to me.
Yeah, you're right.
You want your books in good shape. I'm not sitting here putting it down, but some guys, they buy them and they have them, you know, bagged and boarded or slabbed, and you can't read them, and that's why I'm getting them, is to read them. And you know, sometimes I buy old books with, you know, tears. Well, you convinced me to buy that Alex Toth Batman, you know, and it didn't have a cover. But you can still read it, you know. I mean, it's, you know.
And actually, it tastes is when I got one of my not the biggest score I ever got at Comic Con, but I got a really good deal. There was one day that I went there, and they had like a little magazine section, and of course. I'm looking through there, and they had a bunch of, like, creepies and eeries in decent shape, readable shape, but they had them, for whatever reason, somebody put them in there, and they didn't, like, check the price. Not that they were probably that much expensive, but they were put at $2 each. So, you know, of course, me, who I probably had some of them anyway, like, saw, like, a bunch of them. So I, like, go in there, and I grab, like, about 40, 50 bucks worth of them, you know, and they're like, wow, you're buying all of these, huh? And I go, oh, yeah, this is some of my favorite comics. So it's like, okay. So I didn't buy all of them. I bought a bunch of them, but I didn't buy all of them. Next week I went back, the prices had gone up on them. I think somebody, like, wised up or something.
Hey, I'm going to call you out on this one.
All right.
We just ordered, you know, like I said, this online seller. Now, a running joke was I keep buying some of the books I like, but when I find them in a dollar pile.
Yeah.
And a lot of times we go to stores. I'm trying to convince Al to buy these books. I says, oh, have you seen this? Do you have this? You seen it? It's really good. Do you seen this? He won't touch it. I ended up buying it myself because somebody's got to love it. And when we just did our order, I bought an old issue of Amazing Heroes because it was about that Coyote comic that
I
keep
buying. Yeah, you keep buying number one.
But it has a painted Steve Laiolola cover.
Yeah,
that's why I bought it.
Yeah,
and then it has an interview with, you know, Steve Englehart and Steve Laiolola. Okay, so I got it. But I found out my friend pulled something. What did you do? Oh, don't give me that look. You bought some Challenge of the Unknown issues that you already have.
No, I didn't have
these.
You
can't find. You said there was two or three that you already have, but you couldn't find them.
Oh, yeah. No, that's true. I bought these three Challenges of the Unknowns, and the story, you know, they're all basically one story, jobs or whatever, but they talk about how Red was killed, and I'm looking at them and go, that's right, there's only three Challengers. It's Challengers of the Unknown 59. This one's 57 and 62. And then I said, what issue did he die in? So I went through like the DC database and I saw issue 55 and I went, oh, I have that book, but I don't know where it is.
So he buys another one.
No, I didn't buy it. No, it's not one of these, but I might buy it because I don't know if I want to go through all the boxes. No, I didn't buy it. No. It was before one of these, but it was like, I forgot that Red got killed. So I was like, okay, well, I got to find it. And if I can't find it, and if I see it at my comic shop for $2 or $3, I'll buy another one. Hey,
okay.
If I see Creepies and Eeries and Famous Monsters, I'll buy them. And there's like $2, I'll buy them just because they might be in better condition than the ones that I have. Or just because, like, I like them like you do. But you keep buying Coyote number one. See, I go through all different books. You just keep buying Coyote number one.
To me, Coyote number one, I just got out of boot camp. And I was waiting for that. I was excited about it. And when I got out of boot camp, came home, and the guy had a pile of comics saved. And I got that. And, you know, sometimes you're excited about a book and you read it. It's like, you know, this one, I read it and I just thought, how did he do that? The story just flowed. The artwork flowed. It was, to me, the most perfect comic story. The second issue was really good as well. And then, all of a sudden, the third issue, he wasn't on it. It was another guy. And I'm like, what?
Yeah, you're right.
Biggest disappointment. But whenever I still pull out that first issue and look at it, and I just thought, everything I'd ever dream of doing in a comic book, he pulled it off. And the storytelling, the layouts, the way he drew, everything to me, and the color. Steve Olaf did the coloring on it.
Yeah.
It was just, to me, the perfect comic book. And, you know, they were just rare, obscure books nobody really seemed to have. And then when I saw it at Wilson's, I thought, what? I've always had this fear of something happening to mine, and I wouldn't be able to
find
them.
Yeah, that's it. That's
so
it.
So they're there for a dollar. Sure, I'll get them. And then
that's it. Because I found like some old comics that I had or magazines, and all of a sudden the cover's torn. I'm going like, shit, I got to buy this over again. So now I do the same thing. If it's cheap and it looks really in nice shape, I'll rebuy it just in case I either lose it or it's beat up. Or I found some freaking creepy that I had in the garage there. And it's like, I think it was bagged, or if it wasn't bagged, but it looked like the fucking roaches chewed up the binding on it, because they liked the glue or whatever, those little rat bastards. So it's like, of course I'm gonna buy doubles and triples of these books, and I love them too much.
See, I just keep hoping somebody will like them as much as I, and I'll be glad to give. I tried to give it to my daughter. You seen this? You want it? No. I showed them to Dallas. Dallas looked at them. You want? No. So I've got 8 copies of the first issue, and I think 3 or 4 of the second issue, which, I mean, I'm happy about. And I'll be honest with you, if I go to some other store and I see some others for a dollar, they're going home.
Jeez, man. Well, I'm going to have to, you know, we'll have to call the Aloha to, like, you know, you have to see if we can interview him for the show or something.
I love him. I haven't, I guess he's been inking a lot, and that's fine, but he used to, once in a while, he'd draw a Doctor Strange issue in the 80s.
Yeah, they were nice.
They were just wonderful. And there was one book, Cleo showed up. You know, her and Doctor Strange were separated, his silver-haired girlfriend. And just the way he drew her, she just looked magical. How does he do this, you know? But I liked it when he penciled and inked his own work. I don't care. When he just inks, I'm sure it's fine. But I like to see the whole
thing.
Now,
was Coyote Eclipse, or was it Epic Comics?
Well,
it
started out with Eclipse. Marshall Rogers drew it. It was a graphic novel called I Am Coyote.
That's right.
I never got it. Pat had it, and I'd always pick it up and look through it, and I just never wanted to buy it. I like Marshall Rogers, but I don't know. It just didn't interest me. Well, when Epic was coming up, they offered, you know, Steve, I think originally, I just read a little bit of that Amazing Heroes. But when Jim Starlin was doing Dreadstar, you know, and he was going to start doing that as the first Epic comic, which my daughter got signed by Jim Starlin. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
But they needed a backup strip for Dreadstar. And so Steve Englehart, you know, was doing Coyote, and he thought, well, I guess I could put an 8-page story of Coyote in it and continue it on. So that's where it came about. Well, Marshall Rogers had no interest in drawing it. He wanted to do the graphic novel, and that was it. He wanted to go on. So they brought in Steve Laiolola. Well, next thing you know, Jim Starlin expanded the strip, and, you know, Dreadstar took up the whole issue, you know, the whole book. And so that was that. And then they said, well, do you think you could expand yours into a whole book? Well, yeah, I guess we could. So Coyote was supposed to be the second of the Epic books that was coming out. And it came out beautifully. And I was really shocked when I saw those first 2 issues of Coyote. And then it was forever before the third one ever came out. And then when it did come out, I think Butch Geis drew it. You know, which, I mean, it's fine, but he's a completely different artist than Steve Laiolola. And it was just kind of jarring. And Steve Englehart was talking about it. He says, well, the reason Steve Laiolola left, he says, everybody was astounded and staggered by the first issue, you know, of what he did. And he says, and I was too. And he says, but you were. Oh, yeah.
Are.
But he said that it took him like seven months, I think, to do that first issue.
Really?
Well, it shows. I mean, you know, like I said, everything in there was well thought out and well done. And he says it took him, I think he said, reading it, it took him 7 months to do the first issue, and it took 4 to do the second issue. And he says, you know, how am I going to make any money, you know, if we just put out a few comics a year? So, you know, I guess Butch Geis stepped in and did the third issue. And then they got another guy who was actually good. He had a different style, but it was, you know, he went along with what Laiolola did. I bought that one, too, and then I stopped. But if he would have started and done the whole series himself, I would have bought them all, you know. But, again, it's just like, you know, I just love those first 2 issues, and I still have this dream that Steve Laiolola will step in and redraw all the other issues that came out.
For you.
For me.
Nobody else can see them.
Oh, no. Everybody can see them.
Okay.
That way, everybody can get the whole story in a really nice trade paperback. They, ah, God, all these years, Don was right. No wonder he kept buying those for 50 cents and a dollar.
Now he's got them all. He's going to be rich now because he's the only one that has them.
I'd give them to everybody for free if they wanted them.
Now, that's an Epic comic, so there comes another topic. Apparently, Epic was suing Kaluta and Elaine Lee for Starstruck, and I guess Disney, Marvel, whatever. They're now getting litigious now and like suing people for characters that I guess they think they own but they don't own. I'm wondering if they're going to do that to Coyote, because even it was in Steve Bissett's blog called Myron. He does have a blog and he goes on about it, and he was talking at the, I think the last thing he said was, well, now that you know this case was settled, even though like they shouldn't have even done it, I'm wondering if anybody else that created for Epic's going to be, you know, worried about it. Well, Dreadstar and Coyote, I guess, too, and you know, whatever other Epic books came out around that time.
Yeah, I read a little bit that they were going after Elaine Lee and Michael Kaluta for Starstruck, but that didn't start out at Epic. You know, that was an off-Broadway play that Elaine Lee and her sister did. And then they met Michael Kaluta, and he started doing work with them. And then they did the Starstruck graphic novel.
The graphic novel,
but that was serialized in Heavy Metal first.
Was it? Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
All right.
And it was being serialized in 82, and then Marvel put it out in a graphic novel in 1984.
And they did New Adventures of Starstruck.
Well, yeah, but they did that Heavy Metal story in one of their standard graphic novel formats, the European size. And then they did the 8 issues of the Starstruck comic book, which continued on. And so, like I said, it was its own thing before Epic ever got involved. For people that's too young to remember, Marvel had an Epic line, which was creator-owned work. And they had some really fantastic series. Jim Starlin was doing his Dreadstar series. I want to say he did a second series. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, there was more than one Dreadstar series, yeah.
But then, who was it?
Lealoha,
yeah,
did.
Yeah, Steve Coyote. Englehart and Steve Lealola did a Coyote. And then there was one of my favorites, Time Spirits by Tom Yates.
That's
right.
That was a nice one, too.
And Steve Perry. It was 8 issues. I love that. And then Starstruck came out at the same time. They also did a Sisterhood of Steel with...
That's right. The Sisterhood of Steel.
Mike Volsberg. And I can't remember the woman's name that wrote it. But, God, those were... And, again, it was 8 issues.
That's right.
And,
yeah.
Time Spirits, and I saw Time Spirits at Wilson's. They had several of the issues for a dollar, and I was trying to get Al to buy them, and Al's to buy them. Neither one of them would.
Well, I have some of them already,
Yeah.
But I don't know which ones I'm missing.
What a terrific! And Steve Perry, the writer, ended up. He lived somewhere around here, and there was something about a van. He was in a lot of trouble. He, you know, he's gone now.
But, oh wow, there's a lot of Epic titles. I didn't realize.
Well,
I
was buying it because I liked them. What was it? Alien Legion was another
Alien
one.
Alien Legion. Akira came out through Epic.
Yeah, that was later, but that was a Japanese import.
Boz Chronicles came out through...
That was Brent Blevins, and I can't
remember. That was a nice one, yeah. Some of the Clive Barker books, Book of the Damned and stuff like that, Nightbreed.
Oh, The One. Yeah, that was the other Jim Starlin.
Yeah, The One, yeah. Crash Coyote, Crash Ryan, Dreadstar, The ElfQuest stuff came out through Epic, too.
Yeah.
Epic illustrated the magazine with all the, which is kind of like a Heavy Metal type, you know, book or whatever.
Yeah, Epic Illustrated was a Heavy Metal ripoff that Archie Goodwin edited, which I loved. I had all the issues.
And one that you should know that you didn't mention was Groove.
Yeah, well, what happened was Epic Illustrated was a really popular book, and it'd been out for 2 or 3 years, and finally they started the Epic line of comic books, and then eventually... ElfQuest was a self-published book by a husband and wife team called Richard and Wendy. Was it Peeny or Penny?
Hopefully we don't mess up. I think it's
Peeny. Well, I was watching on Sci-Fi Channel. They were talking to them in an interview, and they kept saying Penny.
Okay, well, then it's Penny.
But I don't know if that's how they say it or if the guy doing the show was like me and can't pronounce anybody's name properly.
Okay.
But anyway, they've self-published their work, and it's some of my favorite comics. And then they ended up putting it out as a newsstand color comic, and it was Epic. But it wasn't like all the other Epic books where you could only get them at comic stores. They were sold at supermarkets and 7-Elevens. And then Grew, one of my very favorite comics, came on and did a 120-issue run under Epic Comics. And again, you can find them at, you know, drugstores, 7-Elevens, grocery stores. They even sold them on the Navy PXs, which was nice.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you know, now it's jogging my memory. Moonshadow was another one. I'm just reading these titles, so we have to go out and look for all the covers, so it'll give us more.
Right. Oh, yeah, I think so. Yeah,
I'll find.
Moonshadow was painted by John J. Ruth.
Ken Williams
did one of them.
Yeah.
And then, what was the writer?
Jay Mateus. Yeah.
And I'll tell you, I think DC Vertigo put that out again, and I think they have a trade, and I cannot recommend that enough. It's a very poetic book, and the words and those painted images just go together. And that first issue, I just found staggering, and all the way through, it has so many pathos, it's so heartfelt, it's kind of bittersweet, and really bizarre. It's like if the poet Keats and Jimi Hendrix decided to do a project together, it would have been Moonshadow.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about all these wild.
Well, there was some I never touched, but I mean, I remember Alan Weiss did a Steel Grip Starkey. Which I bought the first few issues and I stopped. I don't know how many it ran. But it was very diverse. They had all kind of, they had done Martial Law, one of the British artists.
That's right, yeah.
And, I mean, it wasn't just one type of book. It was all kinds of stuff, and it was basically whoever wanted to do something, you could do it any way you wanted to. Tom Yates was talking about Time Spirits that I guess he just thought it'd be four issues, and then he didn't want to keep doing it, but I guess he found out Steve Perry was going to continue the series, so he stuck on with it. And I remember, I think it was the sixth or seventh issue, it changed. He was still drawing it, but the color, it wasn't just the flat colors like it was before. It was process color.
Yeah.
And which, you know, today's readers wouldn't notice any difference because the way comics coloring is now. But at the time, how did he do this? Well, I was reading an interview, and he said that the separators are getting extremely upset at him. Says, this guy doesn't know how to do the comics color. And he was paying out of his pocket to get that process color done. But that's when Jimi Hendrix showed up in the issue.
Yeah, I remember that issue. Yeah.
Oh, God, it was so awesome.
That's Time Spirits.
Yeah, what a...
I remember that.
And I loved how the series ended. I was sorry it ended, but I thought, you know, and they left it open to where it could come up again.
Well, you know, Tom Yates is doing Prince Valiant now, so it's real nice, too.
Tom Yates is one of those artists. The first time I saw him was he had a serialized story in Heavy Metal, and I did not like how he finished his work. It looked like old wood laid in sand for a long time or something. It just had this dead look I didn't enjoy. And again, I was interested in Time Spirits. I liked the painted cover he did for the first issue, and so I read it. I liked it enough, but he grew to be one of my favorite artists, which is kind of funny because I despised him at the beginning and then ended up, hey, wow, this guy's really good.
It happens sometimes.
It happens all the time.
He just did a Tarzan book, a one-shot that I got like a couple of weeks ago.
He loves Tarzan. I think it's one of his favorites.
Yeah, he likes Tarzan and Prince Valiant, I guess. Yeah, now Jerry Gianni, you know, stepped away from Prince Valiant, and now he's... Yates is doing it. It's funny because it's written by Mark Schultz. I'm wondering if when Tom Yates gets tired of doing it, maybe Mark Schultz will start drawing it.
But
I haven't seen a book by him in a long time.
He was on Mr. Media, the local guy, you know, did
Mark Schultz was?
Yeah, he interviewed Mark Schultz. Really interesting guy. But, you know, Mr. Media likes comic books too, you know, and he brought up Xenozoic Tales and talked about that, and he was asking if he was going to do any more. And he said, you know, in this interview that they were going to bring it back, but it was going to be prose, and he was going to do spot illustrations for it.
Okay.
And but, you know, he was talking about, I guess he wrote a foreword or oversaw a book about Al Williamson's Flash Gordon.
I have it, yeah.
But, yeah, he's a really interesting guy. So.
Yeah, he's a great artist. I mean, it's a shame that he's not really, like, doing that much work. I know there's a bunch of sketchbooks that are that are out now of his work, but I'd like to see another comic book story. You know, I mean, Cadillacs and Dinosaurs, or whatever it was called, Xenozoic Tale, whatever it was called.
Yeah, changing the name.
Yeah, well, Cadillacs and Dinosaurs, I guess, was easier to understand better than Xenozoic Tales or whatever. Yeah, I miss his artwork, you know, I mean.
Well, the thing about him, his artwork was staggering, but his writing was just as strong. I never thought about it because I just looked at the art, but when he started writing, I started noticing, yeah, it's really something too.
Well, it's funny because when he did Cenozoic Tales, he would do the first story, and in the backup would be another story by Steve Stiles, who's a decent enough artist, but he was always overshadowed by Mark Schultz or whatever. But I mean, I liked them both, you know. That was kind of like, remember when I think it was called Star Slayer came out, the Star Slayer book there was two stories in it. The first one was Star Slayer by Mike Grill, and it was nice, but then the backup was The Rocketeer by Dave Stevens. So that was the opposite, where the backup feature kind of overshadowed the first feature.
I met this guy, he was an animator, and that's one thing he talked about. He always had a dream. He wanted to do a comic book, an anthology, where he was always talking about getting like four guys to do one. Which Fantagraphics did a book like that called Threat, you know, which there was four guys, and each one had their own stories, all done in a different style. And, you know, he was saying that's what he wanted. You don't have to have a house style. Any way you want to draw, they're going to put it in. Oh, okay. And First Comics did that all the time. Mm-hmm. They had that, what was it? I'm trying to think. They had a series called Mars. And I think Mark Wheatley and Mark Hempel.
That was a nice book.
That was one of my favorite books. But I think they had a backup story in that by a guy named Don Lomax.
I remember Don Lomax.
Yeah, who's a good artist too? But
Don Lomax did a war book.
Yeah, a war book.
War journal or
but
something.
But I can't
like
think
that.
Of why. This is some type of, I don't know what kind of character it was, but it was this fantasy superhero type thing.
Right, yeah.
But it didn't go with Mars at all. It was like, it was almost like buying a Jimi Hendrix album and, you know, having, I don't know, like,
The Partridge Family.
Yeah, like that. You know, it was just, they're both good, but they just don't go together. And, there's a lot of those comic books in the 80s where they were doing that. They had My Girl Star Slayer and The Rocketeer.
Yeah.
You know,
that would be the one, yeah.
You know, but I remember Mike Sines was doing that computer comic, Shatter.
Yeah.
They had that one special issue. You know, Shatter was the first one. It was all done on a Mac. I guess he did it in a program called Paint.
Yeah.
I think it's Paint or Mac Paint. And, you know, it was kind of clunky by today's standards, but in 1984, it was amazing. And I really liked how he's a good artist. He had stories, I think, in Heavy Metal and Epic Illustrated, airbrush artist. But it was a neat story, and basically he was a bounty hunter, and he took a job to buy a canister of Coca-Cola syrup, which was an antique, and you couldn't buy it anymore. And I just thought that was a really clever strip. And basically the person he's going after, he found out the talent. Somebody found a way to take somebody's talent and sell it, and you could buy it, and you could have the gene spliced into you. So if you want to play piano, you could take that from somebody else. And I thought it was a really neat story, and then they ended up putting it together. He brought it back as a backup story in, I don't know, one of my girls' books. I don't know if it was Star Slayer or Sable. But I thought, well, this is kind of bizarre. It didn't really go with that either.
Actually, I want to say that Don Lomax as an artist is way better than the Partridge Family. I didn't mean to compare him to the Partridge Family.
But it was a completely different style than what the guys were doing in Mars. And I thought, you know, I don't mind if they're a different style. We were talking about the Joe Kubert book, and when that guy was an angel and the ape, that didn't bother me so much. But
you know what? Now that you mentioned the Joe Kubert book, this is going back to our comic shop. We haven't gotten the Joe Kubert number two yet of the Joe Kubert book.
I wonder how often it comes out.
It's already out because a friend of mine told me it came out already. I guess
Our
guy, we have to like harass our guy into getting it number two of the Joe Kubert.
Well, he gets the books later than everybody else.
Anyway, that's a whole different story. But yeah, we got to remind him to get him part two of the Joe Kubert anthology series. Jeez. Anyway, I digress.
We're good at that.
Yeah, we're good at digressing. Well, since we're digressing, we're already like past an hour and change, so I guess we might as well call it it up, as they say. Unless you want to talk about something else, the new FF number one, or
yeah, I just picked that up. I Have you read it?
Have you? Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. It's different. It's quirky, as they say in the business.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be. We're talking about the FF number one that Mike Allred drew.
Actually, when you read it, we'll talk about it in the next.
Okay. Well, I was a little disappointed because I thought it'd be the Fantastic Four, and this.
No, it's the the Fantastic Four get these guys to, you know, become what's the name of it? I can't even remember what the name of it. It's not the Fantastic Four. It's cool though because it's Ant-Man. You know, I'm surprised they got Ant-Man, She-Hulk. Who is it? Ant-Man, She-Hulk, and Medusa,
some girl with pink hair and a thing suit.
Yeah, I forgot who she was, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it could be okay.
It's
I
different.
Guess.
Let's put it that way.
I was glancing through. Mike Allred's an artist I like, but sometimes he's.
Well, it's written by Matt Fraction. Yeah. It's definitely interesting. It's definitely like a different take on it.
Well, I'll try it out and see.
Yes, you will. Now you bought it.
Yeah, it is good enough to buy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know you want to read the books before you buy them, but you can't do that anymore because Pat says to us, it's not a library.
Oh, yeah, I never did.
No,
that.
He never did. He never said that to us. He said that to one of our friends once, but that's a whole other story.
He said he didn't.
He said he didn't, but I have confirmation that he did from.
Well, you know, I mean. You don't
that person actually saw an early picture of Pat and he said, oh, that's the guy. All right.
Well, you know, I mean, you can kind of glance through and see you like it and then go. You don't sit there and read them in the store. You mess them up for everybody else.
Well, you know, that's what they do at Barnes and Noble and Borders.
Yeah, well, yeah, I know.
Every time I go there to buy like a monster magazine, I have to go through like 6 copies of Scary Monsters to buy a good one, because every one of them has either like been folded or ripped or something's done to it. Because people sit there at the coffee shop and read them. So
well, you know, when Borders is around, which I really love Borders,
yeah, I miss but Borders. Yeah.
That was the same thing. You go, you know, my daughter would get the manga books. I'd look at a couple of them, and then I'd look at the train wreck of a shelf they had for the comics.
Oh, you know, remember
trades.
That?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But the issue I always had was there would be like, you know, 8 to 16 kids sitting there on the floor leaning against the books to read these manga.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they wouldn't like look to get out of your way.
No.
They'd just sit there and read. And
you'd step over them.
Yeah, you'd step over them and stuff. And that was fine. But sometimes they'd be blocking something I want to look at. And I never had any trouble if I say, could you move on? Oh, yeah, sure. They would. And, I mean, so I never got mad, but I thought, you know, if I was sitting there on the floor reading like that, I would kind of glance up, see if there was anybody's way, and try to get out.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that.
And I was really surprised that they would let them stay there. And,
I mean, it was an interesting concept. We'll leave it at that. I mean, there was one thing I went there. Some kid was sprawled straight across the graphic novels, like if it was his reading in his house. And, I mean, I could never feel that comfortable at a store or whatever, but I'm glad that he did.
Well, it's because when you and I were growing up, they wouldn't let you do that.
No, they kick you out. You know, they look at you and go, like, you're going to buy that? You're going to read that? You're going to buy it? So.
Yeah, they'd chase you out. So I don't know.
But, I mean, I miss Borders. It was a great concept. You know, they just overextended themselves a little too much. It was a cool store. I mean, they didn't really give you any discounts till towards the end when they would send you coupons and then you could get good deals.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, they had bargain books and I was.
Yeah, they did.
Sometimes they were just basically giving those things away and they were great. That's my favorite was U2 had that book, U2 by U2. It was like $60-$70. And it was on Christmas Eve. My daughter said, can we stop there to look? Okay. Well, got it for $5.
Yeah, that
was. And I'm like, what? And I used to get that all the time. That's why I love the store. But
actually, at the one across the street, the Barnes & Noble, that's where I bought. I bought that complete Don Martin. Like it looks like one of the, it's like a 4-volume oversized book for like $20. And it's like a $150 book or whatever. They had it. They had it there. And they had like this one called Men's Adventures, which was a collection of the old men's magazines, cover Stag and from Men on the Other. For like $10 they had it there. I had a couple of scores. More so Barnes & Noble than Borders. Borders was just. They had cooler books.
Well, you know, Dark Horse, when they were putting out the Lone Wolf and Cub books.
Yeah.
I used to go there and get those when they came out. And one time, they had the second series, Samurai Executioner. And I went to Borders in Clearwater, you know, and picked it up. And the guy behind the counter looked at it and says, you're a wise man. And I said, do you read these? And he started talking about Lone Wolf and Cub. I said, yeah, this is the same guys. he wasn't aware of it. And he said, I haven't seen Lone Wolf and Cub in a while. And I explained there was 28 books and, you know, it finished. And he looked. Oh, I didn't know that. And I said, well, you know, you work here, you can order those old books. They're, really? And I said, that's what happened to me. I kept missing them. So my daughter talked to the girl at the counter. And while we're talking, he says, I'm going to do that. I don't know. I missed that. You know, talking to another human being. And
I know.
It was kind of funny because we started talking about martial arts. He said, you train. I said, yeah, so do you. We're completely different styles. We've talked about it for a while. And while we're talking, he's sitting there, okay, I've ordered all the books I'm missing. Thank you very much. Now, what? Tell me about this one. You know, I said, well, it's the same two guys. I didn't realize they did another series. And he's typing it up. He was ordering those, too. I never saw the guy again. But, you know, I mean, that's what I mean about ordering online is great. And especially if you work with friends and, you know, you do it together. That's fun.
Yeah,
but it's really fun when you go and have human contact with somebody. You know, sometimes it can be unpleasant. But once in a while, it's a good thing like that, you know.
Yeah, what I do remember was that Borders would open early, like on Sunday, so I'd be here and I had nothing to do in the morning, and I'd just drive over there. Like, they'd be open at 9 and just grab, like, maybe a magazine and come back home and read it or whatever, you know. So that was, I missed them. I think Barnes & Noble is the, but the Barnes & Noble we have is real, real small one. There's the larger size ones that have a better selection. But
yeah, I don't like the Barnes & Noble over here in St. Pete, but they do have one at Clearwater that I guess is the same size.
It's a bigger
size.
One, right?
It just seems so much nicer. It seems more like how Borders were.
Mm.
I don't know if they laid the store out different or whatever, but I don't enjoy the one we have. But
we don't have Books A Million here either, though. That's another one. We need another bookstore. Gosh darn it.
Thanks for not dropping
that bomb. Yeah, I didn't do it this time. You know, I was going to, but then I said, nah. Or the GD, I didn't do that. I said, gosh darn it, or whatever. So anyway, I guess that's going to wrap it up. Mr.
Anyway,
Don.
Hopefully we'll get the other half.
Let's hope for the other two. Yeah. Maybe for like next year they'll, you know.
Yeah. I don't know what to say about that. They keep, I'll be here. Anyway, in the meantime,
read
more
comic books.